ABC right here on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
On today's program, Gregory Stockel tells us about an invasive fish found in Colorado. Faith Perlow answers a question from an English learner named Tahir. We close by listening to The Californian's Tale by Mark Twain. But first, former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has died after being shot in the chest during a campaign speech Friday, medical officials said. The attack shocked Japan, a nation with some of the most restrictive gun control laws in the world. The 67-year-old Abe died at a hospital in Nara. He had been getting treatment there for gunshot wounds from what police described as a handmade gun. Abe was Japan's longest-serving prime minister. He resigned in 2020 because of a health problem. Videos from Japanese broadcaster NHK showed Abe speaking at a train station in Nara when two gunshots rang out. The former prime minister fell to the ground while holding his chest. His shirt was covered in blood. Medical officials said Abe was not breathing and his heart had stopped after being airlifted to the hospital. Doctors tried to stop the bleeding and gave him a blood transfusion. They said Abe had deep wounds to the heart and the right side of his neck. He was declared dead at 5:03 p.m. local time. Police arrested the suspected gunman at the place of the attack. The suspect has been identified as 41-year-old Tatsuya Yamagami of Nara. He served in Japan's Navy for 3 years until 2005. NHK reported that the suspect told the police that he was not pleased with Abe and wanted to kill him. The man also said he had made several handmade explosives and guns in the past. Japan has very restrictive gun laws that make it almost impossible to buy a gun. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida condemned the attack as barbaric, saying it took place during elections that form the very heart of Japan's democracy. Even before the shooting, Abe was expected to have a major impact on Sunday's election. During his years in office, Abe pulled Japan out of an economic recession. He built strong ties with the United States and wanted to counter China's growing strength in Asia. His goal of rewriting the nation's pacifist constitution failed because of poor public support. Japanese officials have said the election planned for Sunday will still take place. U.S. President Joe Biden said, "This is a tragedy for Japan and for all who knew him." Similar messages of shock and sadness came from leaders around the world, including from neighboring Taiwan, China, and Russia, as well as from across Asia and Europe. The attack shocked Japan. With a population of 125 million, the country had just 10 gun-related criminal cases last year. Police said 8 of those cases were related to gang activities. Tokyo, a city of nearly 14 million people, had no gun incidents, injuries, or deaths last year. Shiro Kawamoto is a professor at the College of Risk Management at Nihon University in Tokyo. He said, "Japanese people are in a state of shock." Kawamoto added, "This serves as a wake-up call that gun violence can happen in Japan, and security to protect Japanese politicians must be re-examined."
Biologists in the American West are worried about an invasive kind of fish recently found in part of the Colorado River. Biologists have been working there to protect native fish, which are threatened by the appearance of the smallmouth bass. National Park Service fisheries biologist Jeff Arnold found three young smallmouth bass in the lower Colorado River recently. The Park Service confirmed that the fish had been found and were likely reproducing in the Colorado River below the Glen Canyon Dam in the southwestern state of Arizona. The Colorado River is a major river of North America. It travels through parts of seven western U.S. states. Construction of the Glen Canyon Dam formed Lake Powell. Smallmouth bass are a popular sport fish, but they feed on another kind of fish called the humpback chub. The humpback chub is an ancient fish that is native to the river, but is threatened. Biologists like Arnold have been working to help the threatened fish recover. Predators like the smallmouth bass have caused problems for the upper river's environment, but they were held back for years in Lake Powell by the Glen Canyon Dam. However, with water levels dropping, the invasive fish have gotten past the dam and closer to where the chub remain. Brian Healy has worked with the humpback chub for more than 10 years. He established the Native Fish Ecology and Conservation Program. Healy said, "It's pretty devastating to see all the hard work and effort you've put into removing other invasive species and translocating populations around to protect the fish, and to see all that effort overturned really quickly." As lake levels drop, non-native fish that live in warm surface waters in Lake Powell are getting closer to the dam and its penstocks. Penstocks are underground steel tubes that carry water to machines that produce electricity from the water current. The water is then released on the other side of the dam. If predator fish continue to flow through the penstocks and populate the river below the dam, they could harm native fish. That could undo years of work restoring the river's environment. The chub almost disappeared years ago, but the fish have come back with help from fish biologists and scientists and engineers. Agencies spend millions of dollars each year to keep invasive species under control in the upper part of the river. The Endangered Species Act is a law that requires government agencies to act in ways that will not harm threatened animals. That includes structures like the Glen Canyon Dam. Federal, state, and other government leaders are expected to release a plan in August containing ideas for policymakers. Their aim is to control smallmouth bass and other predatory fish below the dam. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question from Tahir about the difference between linking verbs and helping verbs. Hello. What is the difference between the verb is in these two sentences. He is a doctor. Is he a doctor? I know the first one is a linking verb. Is the second verb a linking verb or a helping verb? Thanks, Tahir. Thank you, Tahir, for writing to us. Before I answer your question, let's talk about the difference between linking verbs and helping verbs. A linking verb connects the subject of a sentence with more information about the subject. It is not an action verb. The verb to be and all of its forms are the most common linking verb. Other linking verbs include become, seem, and sense verbs like feel and smell in some sentences. Here's an example of a linking verb. My cat is 3 years old. The verb in this sentence is connects the subject, my cat, to more information about him, that he is 3 years old. Helping or auxiliary verbs are also used along with a main verb. Auxiliary verbs help the main verb and the rest of the sentence by giving additional information about the verb, like tense. We have three main helping verbs in English: be, do, and have. Here's an example of a helping verb. My cat is watching birds from the window. In the sentence, the helping verb is to be, in the third person singular, is. It is helping the verb watch along with the present participle ending, ing, to become the present progressive tense. In this sentence, the verb is cannot stand on its own. It needs a main verb like watch. Back to your question, Tahir. In your first example, the verb is a linking verb. He is a doctor. The verb is connects the subject of he with the rest of the sentence that describes the subject. Here, the verb is can stand on its own without another main verb, so it is not a helping or auxiliary verb. The second example is actually a yes or no question. We switch the verb to the first position and the subject to the second position to get a question. Is he a doctor? In this question, is has a special status called an operator. It does not need another helping or auxiliary verb to make a question, because it had the role as a linking verb in the original sentence. Here's another example of a linking verb changing to an operator within a question. Is Washington, D.C. the capital of the United States? The answer would be, of course, yes. Washington, D.C. is the capital of the United States. In the sentence, the linking verb is connects Washington, D.C. with the rest of the information about the city. In the question form, is begins the question as an operator. It switches places with the subject, Washington, D.C., to create the question. To tell if the verb to be is a linking verb or a helping verb, see if there's another verb in the sentence. If there is, then to be acts as a helping or auxiliary verb. If to be is alone and connects the subject to more information about it, then it is a linking verb. Please let us know if these examples and explanations have helped you, Tahir. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
Our story today is called The Californian's Tale. It was written by Mark Twain. Here is Shep O'Neill with the story.
When I was young, I went looking for gold in California. I never found enough to make me rich, but I did discover a beautiful part of the country. It was called the Stanislaus. The Stanislaus was like heaven on earth. It had bright green hills and deep forests where soft winds touched the trees. Other men, also looking for gold, had reached the Stanislaus Hills of California many years before I did. They had built a town in the valley with sidewalks and stores, banks and schools. They had also built pretty little houses for their families. At first, they found a lot of gold in the Stanislaus Hills, but their good luck did not last. After a few years, the gold disappeared. By the time I reached the Stanislaus, all the people were gone too. Grass now grew in the streets, and the little houses were covered by wild rose bushes. Only the sound of insects filled the air as I walked through the empty town that summer day so long ago. Then I realized I was not alone after all. A man was smiling at me as he stood in front of one of the little houses. This house was not covered by wild rose bushes. A nice little garden in front of the house was full of blue and yellow flowers. White curtains hung from the windows and floated in the soft summer wind. Still smiling, the man opened the door of his house and motioned to me. I went inside and could not believe my eyes. I had been living for weeks in rough mining camps with other gold miners. We slept on the hard ground, ate canned beans from cold metal plates, and spent our days in the difficult search for gold. Here in this little house, my spirit seemed to come to life again. I saw a bright rug on the shining wooden floor. Pictures hung all around the room, and on little tables there were seashells, books, and china vases full of flowers. A woman had made this house into a home. The pleasure I felt in my heart must have shone on my face. The man read my thoughts. "Yes," he smiled, "it is all her work. Everything in this room has felt the touch of her hand." One of the pictures on the wall was not hanging straight. He noticed it and went to fix it. He stepped back several times to make sure the picture was really straight. Then he gave it a gentle touch with his hand. "She always does that," he explained to me. "It is like the finishing pat a mother gives her child's hair after she has brushed it. I have seen her fix all these things so often that I can do it just the way she does. I don't know why I do it. I just do it." As he talked, I realized there was something in this room that he wanted me to discover. I looked around. When my eyes reached a corner of the room near the fireplace, he broke into a happy laugh and rubbed his hands together. "That's it," he cried out. "You have found it. I knew you would. It is her picture." I went to a little black shelf that held a small picture of the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. There was a sweetness and softness in the woman's expression that I had never seen before. The man took the picture from my hands and stared at it. She was 19 on her last birthday. That was the day we were married. When you see her, oh, just wait until you meet her. "Where is she now?" I asked. "Oh, she is away," the man sighed, putting the picture back on the little black shelf. "She went to visit her parents. They live 40 or 50 miles from here. She has been gone 2 weeks today." "When will she be back?" I asked. "Well, this is Wednesday," he said slowly. "She will be back on Saturday, in the evening." I felt a sharp sense of regret. "I am sorry, because I will be gone by then," I said. "Gone? No, why should you go? Don't go. She will be so sorry. You see, she likes to have people come and stay with us." "No, I really must leave," I said firmly. He picked up her picture and held it before my eyes. "Here," he said. "Now you tell her to her face that you could have stayed to meet her and you would not." Something made me change my mind as I looked at the picture for a second time. I decided to stay. The man told me his name was Henry. That night, Henry and I talked about many different things, but mainly about her. The next day passed quietly. Thursday evening, we had a visitor. He was a big, gray-haired miner named Tom. "I just came for a few minutes to ask when she's coming home," he explained. "Is there any news?" "Oh, yes," the man replied. "I got a letter. Would you like to hear it?" He took a yellowed letter out of his shirt pocket and read it to us. It was full of loving messages to him and to other people, their close friends and neighbors. When the man finished reading it, he looked at his friend. "Oh, no, you are doing it again, Tom. You always cry when I read a letter from her. I'm going to tell her this time." "No, you must not do that, Henry," the gray-haired miner said. "I am getting old, and any little sorrow makes me cry. I really was hoping she would be here tonight." The next day, Friday, another old miner came to visit. He asked to hear the letter. The message in it made him cry, too. "We all miss her so much," he said. Saturday finally came. I found I was looking at my watch very often. Henry noticed this. "You don't think something has happened to her, do you?" he asked me. I smiled and said that I was sure she was just fine. But he did not seem satisfied. I was glad to see his two friends, Tom and Joe, coming down the road as the sun began to set. The old miners were carrying guitars. They also brought flowers and a bottle of whiskey. They put the flowers in vases and began to play some fast and lively songs on their guitars. Henry's friends kept giving him glasses of whiskey, which they made him drink. When I reached for one of the two glasses left on the table, Tom stopped my arm. "Drop that glass and take the other one," he whispered. He gave the remaining glass of whiskey to Henry just as the clock began to strike midnight. Henry emptied the glass. His face grew whiter and whiter. "Boys," he said, "I am feeling sick. I want to lie down." Henry was asleep almost before the words were out of his mouth. In a moment, his two friends had picked him up and carried him into the bedroom. They closed the door and came back. They seemed to be getting ready to leave, so I said, "Please don't go, gentlemen. She will not know me. I am a stranger to her." They looked at each other. "His wife has been dead for 19 years, Tom said. "Dead?" I whispered. "Dead or worse," he said. "She went to see her parents about 6 months after she got married. On her way back, on a Saturday evening in June, when she was almost here, the Indians captured her. No one ever saw her again. Henry lost his mind. He thinks she is still alive. When June comes, he thinks she has gone on her trip to see her parents. Then he begins to wait for her to come back. He gets out that old letter, and we come around to visit so he can read it to us. On the Saturday night she is supposed to come home, we come here to be with him. We put a sleeping drug in his drink so he will sleep through the night. Then he is all right for another year. Joe picked up his hat and his guitar. "We have done this every June for 19 years, he said. "The first year there were 27 of us. Now just the two of us are left." He opened the door of the pretty little house, and the two old men disappeared into the darkness of the Stanislaus.
You have just heard the story, The Californian's Tale. It was written by Mark Twain and adapted by Donna DeSanctis. Your storyteller was Shep O'Neill. This is Shirley Griffith.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.